extend the session by a couple minutes, perhaps around 15 minutes, so we can continue with our questions, because I know there are some questions. So we'll start with a couple questions to the last two panelists, and then we'll open it up to all four. So the microphone, the first question is on the front. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. I have a question for Michael. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how young people and legal practitioners would be able to get more involved in environmental mediation within Canada, and not necessarily in the international framework, but subnationally, possibly with Aboriginal people related to natural resource issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There was a question up front.
So this weekend we'll begin in Paris the 21st Conference of the Parties, and the major subject will be, the major objective will be to reach an agreement on CO2 emission reduction. And I think we can agree to say that climate change will just increase the number of conflicts linked with natural resources. So do you think it's a good idea to focus on this subject? Or do you feel that there is some subject that will miss, that will be missing in this conference?
Hi, this question is to Professor Brown. So Professor Brown, thank you for this guide. It's absolutely fantastic. And I'm curious, though, as you're looking forward, what do you see as the most important steps in making sure that it has effective implementation out there, past the edges of this campus?
Okay, I'll stop the questions there. I'll hand the floor to Michael, and then we'll continue with the broader round of questions. Okay, sure. So the first question was about how do law students engage in mediation? Where do we get experience and exposure in Canada?
In terms of getting exposure or getting involved, I think that that's a question. I've been having some conversations. I know that Louise teaches a course on mediation in the law faculty. I would shamelessly suggest people consider that course who are in the law school.
All my students are present.
And I think that actually it's a question that I know I'm recently back to Quebec, and it's one of the questions that I'm thinking about an awful lot. I don't have a quick answer, but I think it's a very important question. I'd like to think there are going to be some discussions around that exact issue in the coming weeks and months. I think I'll leave it at that for.
François, did you want to tackle the question of climate change and security? If not, I can certainly tackle it. I can tackle that question.
I think you're perfectly suited for that.
Absolutely. We anticipate climate change, obviously, to have a major effect on natural resources, causing more competition over natural resources and potentially creating more conflict. And we're definitely pushing in the Paris Comp to actually put that on the agenda. We're having two side events looking at climate change and security. And we're at the actual event, we're launching a new partnership with the EU, $5.5 million partnership on climate change and security, trying to help countries identify where the most vulnerable areas are to the security implications of climate change, and then actually working at the community level to try to build up their resilience to risks and shocks from climate change. So it's definitely an issue. It's definitely on our radar screen, and we have a new program in the process of being designed to address it, and we are certainly trying to put it on the agenda.
The implementation question.
One point, as a follow-up to what you just said, I think we have to consider the difficulty that governments have in considering migration, internal migration in part, but certainly international migration, as a proper adaptation measure to climate change. They have great difficulty in thinking it through.
I think the last question, the question about implementation, it's a very big one for those of us who've been working on this. And I guess where we're at right now is the guidebook. The UN's been able to put together something that consolidates, like we were talking about, decades of hands-on experience. This launch is part of a series of launches we're doing around the world in a number of places. And what I think, you know, what we can say that's very clear is the response has been incredibly strong. There's a general, I mean, there's a clear message. Yes, you've got it in terms of the content. Yes, this is a fundamentally important issue. Yes, mediation is an important, mediation and related approaches have an important contribution in this area. So I know the UN, and David may have some more detailed comments on it, but I mean the UN is actively wanting to build on the momentum coming out of the guide, and we're looking at ways of institutionalizing in some manner the ability to deliver on the kinds of ideas that are documented in the guide. We're very well aware that there's the need to build capacity around the world in a number of particular regions and in a long list of particular countries. We're very, very well aware there's a need for a new generation of people who can bridge these areas of expertise that unfortunately, at this point in time, there are not lots of people who can bridge the different areas of expertise and also operate in the challenging sort of international environment of complicated states. We are certainly sitting here with the McGill hat. We're very happy to have been coordinating with the UN Environment Program, and we'll see if we're able to see some kind of collaborative efforts moving forward from here.
Exactly. And as I said, when we started this whole process, that was definitely one of our end goals, was to find an institution that we could potentially partner with going forward. And I do hope that we can have this continue this dialogue with McGill on creating, as you say, institutionalizing this and providing more systematic mediation support around natural resources. Let's go back to the floor for questions. There's a question on the side. Two.
Is it for everyone? Yeah. Hello. Sorry. I have a question for Michael about the kind of natural resources conflicts in Guatemala. Many of those mining conflicts, on the company side, many of these companies are Canadian, like companies like Goldcorp in the Marlin mine conflict and Tahoe Resources in the Escobal mine conflict. And do you think any of this mediation, especially in terms of, let's say, justice for some of the abuses committed by these Canadian companies, should this be happening in Canada?
Take a couple more questions and then we'll go to the end, the panelists. Thanks.
With the use of these UN guidelines, I was wondering how, once a body of cases develops where they've been implemented and they've shown to be effective, would you use them then to identify conflicts before they necessarily arise? And whether you have some sort of database that you're building with common features across conflicts so that you can use those as signifiers and kind of get in with mediation at the start.
And one more question. The front row, please.
Question for Professor Kripo. It's for international like migration. Like, so there's a tension between the national interest and the migrants. And specifically, do you think it is important to distinguish between temporal migrants and permanent migrants, again, and how do we distinguish between like the duration of the migration? Like, is it, because I see the difference between the terms, immigration and immigration. Like, so for me, it sounds like migrants are more permanent and more temporal, and immigrants are more like permanent, and migrants are more temporal. So do you think it is important to distinguish between two groups?
Thank you. Why don't we start with Michael, and then we'll move to Francois for the responses.
Sure. I guess two of them that jump out. First, the question of natural resource conflicts in Guatemala. I think a couple of points on that. One is mediation has a place. It also isn't the tool for everything, and you don't necessarily mediate human rights violations, for example. You don't mediate illegal acts, for example. But that said, there are a wide range of tools that go in the toolkit that I've tried to talk about that are extremely useful and pertinent in order to improve discussion, dialogue, improve the transparency and access to information, improve the kind of communication that takes place, because it can allow people to sort of cross over differences. And the example I gave quickly in Guatemala, well, I mentioned in that example, although I was called down with sort of the hope that, you know, is mediation a kind of gonna solve everything, and I was very clear, no, at the level of individual disputes, where we're talking about structural and systemic problems that are part of the dynamic, mediation isn't going to be your solution. But there was a whole range of tools and approaches that could be helpful. Mediation can have a place at the higher level when countries are at a point where they're in a situation where they can address the broader structural and systemic issues. So again, it has a place, but it isn't necessarily the tool where you're looking at certain kinds of violations that are playing themselves out. The second data to help prevent conflicts, a resounding absolutely, that is what is very important. It's very needed, and it can be very helpful. I remember a number of years back, I was invited down and worked with the Office of the Presidency in Bolivia to help set up an early warning and early response system in regards to resource conflicts. And I just, for those in the field, the tendency often is to talk about early warning systems where you sort of collect the information and you can see the indicators coming. Not wanting to turn it into a lengthy discussion, but it's really important to get beyond early warning. We need to build systems that have early warning and early response built into them. I will leave it at that, but there may be some issues in those questions that Jeffrey may also want to take a stab at, but I'll leave it there.
Thanks, Michael. Francois?
Yes, I'm not sure where the question was heading, but I have a few elements. Distinction between temporary and permanent migration. Each migration situation is different. It depends on the conflict or the situation in the country that is left, and I'm talking here about international migration. You could add to that internal migration, which is a whole other ballgame. And we've seen very different situations. For example, Kosovo. Thousands of people poured out of Kosovo when Kosovo was in crisis. 5,000 were taken into Canada. More than half of them went back relatively quickly, within a few years. Same thing for the Bosnians that were in Germany. Most of them went back. So not permanent. The conditions that were given to them in Germany were very precarious, and that also helps explain why they went back. Syria, at present, Syria is utterly destroyed. If we think that the Syrians that are out of Syria at the moment and are going to Europe are going to go back to Syria anytime soon, I think we're deluded. So it's something, you know, Europe needs to think about receiving 7 or 8 million Syrians in the coming years. And they're not. So each migration depends. And I think one element that I'd like to stress is the element of early warning. I mentioned that before, but I think when you talk about early warning, I think migrants are a key factor. Listening to migrants, listening to the first migrants who come, they are by themselves an early warning system. And we usually don't take that into account enough, and we're certainly not listening to them because they're always considered outsiders. They're outsiders in the communities they've left because they've left, and they're outsiders in the communities that they've joined because they have too recently joined. And so we're dismissing their experience, and yet they have lots to say about the situations that have been left, and they have lots to say about how they would envisage going back and be part of a resolution of the conflict. So,
thank you very much. And just to add to this, the question of early warning, the work we did with John Unruh, these are three of the books. There's actually six of them. They total about 150 case studies. They're all about natural resources in post-conflict settings. A lot of this was actually done as the groundwork to start to come up with better systems of early warning, identification of conflict as far upstream as possible. So that is the goal that we're aiming for. I'll take one more question to the panel, and then I'm going to ask the panelists. We've got a room here full of
potential future resource mediators, what's the one piece of wisdom, what's the one piece of advice, something from the guide that you really like or something from your own experience that you want to drill home to the room? So just be thinking about that, the one really key piece of advice to a room full of future potential mediators. So one or two more questions from the floor. One question here, and then we'll go to the advice.
Thank you. So I'm taking Professor John Onru's Geography of Development course, and during the class we learned that international development intervenes in peace building process and resolves the conflict, but it doesn't last long and another conflict arises. So how do you ensure that mediation intervention has a long-lasting impact in the community?
So this is basically the question of implementation as well as long-term conflict prevention and building the capacity to resolve disputes as they go forward. Panelists, I can start with Michael if you want to share some thoughts on that.
On the question?
Yeah, on the question.
Yes, it's when you have resource disputes, it's particularly in complicated. It applies anywhere, but when we're talking the complicated international context of weaker state situations, developing country situations, in many ways I see the crisis or the conflict that has brought attention to it as an opportunity. And often you're dealing in situations where when you get the chance to get together, things have got to the point that it brings people in to try and help solve the dispute or address the dispute. That's an opportunity to readjust how things are going to go in terms of the future. So in many ways, it's about linking any kind of mediation process or good process that brings people together around a conflict to start setting up the kinds of mechanisms and identify the kinds of priorities that people need in order to address their needs in a longer-term situation. In terms of the mixing of, and that applies whether we're talking sort of localized dispute or higher level. One of the things, I was recently on a panel of, the government recently called some of us in who'd been doing mediation in the international domain to reflect on some of our experiences. And one of the key lessons that came out of those of us that had been doing this internationally was that you have to get outside of a kind of traditional mediator thinking where you're just focused on the dispute. Because in the international context, the dispute's just usually a symptom of underlying problems. And it's an opportunity to then help people think through longer term development needs and longer term planning that is more inclusive, more democratic, and covers a wider spectrum of people who typically involve those who've been left out a long time.
Anybody further want to add to that? If not, then we'll go for the sage advice to the audience. And I won't wrap up after the sage advice, so this will be the wrap-up, and then we'll pass the floor back to Phil. So, Michael, do you want to start with your sage advice?
I love that idea. I guess one thing, you asked the question about anyone who is thinking possibly of working in this field. I would underscore one thing. When I've looked back at the years of what I've done for a long time, I've correctly or enormous error in my life always been attracted to the issues that are most complicated and most complex. That applies when I started off in my geography training at McGill University, and it applies when I went into law, and consistently I've always, in every area, I've been attracted to complicated problems and the complex stuff that typically brings together a multiplicity of disciplines that's wrapped up into complicated tensions and complicated human relations. So that's a comment that if that doesn't interest you, if it doesn't like you, if your sort of spine goes, ow, I don't want that, it's probably not the right field. But if that stuff attracts you and you always find yourself intellectually and emotionally engaged in those kinds of in that kind of dynamic, then you probably have a real lot of good latent mediator in you.
Thanks, Michael. Jeffrey?
In terms of my own experience I think what I would propose to you is that as you go forward, you need to always keep an open mind, that there are no blacks or whites, that the world is made up of gray zones, and that different shades of gray. And what seems to be the case may not always be what it appears to be. So you have to dig deeper. You have to be open to different points of view and opinions if you want to bridge gaps and close differences and create a pathway to peace.
Thank you very much. Francois?
I was very much struck in 1994 at the UN Summit for Social Development at the complete dialogue de sourds between the development people and the human rights people. The fact that the development people were portrayed by the human rights people as wanting to define community needs top-down, and the human rights people, I'm a human rights person, so, and the human rights people were portraying themselves as wanting to allow individuals to define how they want to express their own rights. I think portrayal was probably unfair for both sides, but there was a dialogue de sourds. We couldn't speak the same language. What I like in the development of mediation is that we're tackling at the same time the community level and the individual level. We have a process whereby we listen to individuals, trying to understand what their rights are, how they want to express themselves on what they want, and at the same time, trying to define community needs, which can be across the different communities, like the example you were mentioning in Central Asia. And to me, mediation is precisely the kind of mechanism where you try to bridge the cultural divide. And if, again, that's one of the complexities you were describing, if you're interested in the rights discourse and the development discourse, that's one of the ways to make them actually work together.
Thank you. And Louise, a final word, final sage advice from your side?
I rarely give advice. And I don't support to receive advice, too. So, you know, I'm in a neutral zone. But I would say that to be a mediator is a blessing. And when I implemented, just to give you, when I implemented judicial mediation at the Court of Appeal of Quebec 20 years ago, all judges were against that. Judges cannot mediate. What's that? And one of the strongest legal minds of my court accepted to conduct a mediation. And after the mediation, at the end of the afternoon, he came to my office and says, Louise, I feel so, you know, blessed by what happened to me. I've never felt such an experience of my life. And he was, and he still is a great judge. So just the feeling of being in a mediation room or in a mediation area with conflicting parties and then help them alleviate their suffering and knowing that mediation is just a step-by-step approach. If you feel like I want to have permanent results, no, it's not for you. It's today that it's happened. And you know that it's the rule in our life. It should be the here and now. This is mediation.
Thank you very much. I think just a quick round of applause for our panelists and for the sage advice they've given us. Yeah, none of it's still there. Phil?